really for me it came around for two reasons. One, I wasn't proving to be very successful at road cycling, and so I decided I needed to do something else. And then two, I really enjoyed going touring and exploring and things, and so I combined, you know, having a competitive nature and a love of explore, and I'd heard about the Transcontinental, and I thought it was like the perfect solution to combine everything that I love doing on a bicycle.
This is Explore by the Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. Adventure starts anywhere.
You found it all right then?
Yeah, easy. I just followed the blue dot on my phone.
Shall we go and get a coffee then?
Science in sport. Fueled by science.
Welcome to episode one of Explore by the Cycling Podcast. My name is Lionel Burney, and if you listen to the regular cycling podcast, you'll know who I am. But I'm joined by Hannah Troop. Hello, Hannah. Welcome to Explore.
Hello, Lionel. Thank you for having me along.
Are you looking forward to being involved? Six-part series looking at basically anything that happens on two wheels.
Yeah, it's going to be good. And there's a lot of interesting stories and from all corners of the world. So, yeah, it's definitely going to be an interesting one to follow.
Well, we're going to be your guides through a world of cycling that I've really been finding a lot out about in recent weeks and months. What's been the most enjoyable bike ride you've done this year, Hannah?
Well, I think once you venture into the realm of endurance riding, it's a kind of what's been described to me as a type two fun. So I think enjoyable but not enjoyable bike ride was probably when I did the ETAP this year in July, which was pretty punchy. And yeah, it was probably one of the hardest days I've had on the bike.
Well, we're going to hear about that ETAP ride a little bit later on in the series. We'll also hear about my most enjoyable day on a bike I spent with Ned Bolting, very much not type 2 fun, it was type 1 fun, because while I'm here as the kind of conduit for ordinary cyclists who don't want to spend hours and hours and hours in the saddle, I did it in a very middle class of Waitrose kind of way. So we'll hear about that a little bit later on in this six-part series called Explore. We'll be talking to all sorts of people, riders who've ridden around the world, someone who rode to Australia, someone who rode across Australia, people who've raced across Europe, someone who set a record from Land's End to John O'Groats. We'll talk to the slow cyclist, we'll talk to record breakers, professional riders and leisure riders. It's not all about hardcore cycling. It's not all about camping in a bivy bag by the side of the road or on a roundabout. As I said, I'll be explaining my own take on bikepacking, which is very much doing it in a kind of luxury sort of way. But this first episode is going to focus on the European race, the Transcontinental.
As we head off tonight, you know, straight through the night, hopefully I kind of don't fall asleep again. I got tired last year and I had nearly a 2 hour sleep. Hopefully I can make it through the first night. If I need to sleep, I'll sleep.
You don't feel good, you feel awful. Because your body has just taken a huge amount of abuse. You're riding your bike, which is quite an unnatural thing to do, far too much, and you're not giving your body anywhere near the amount of rest it should have.
It's going to be a hard, hard fight. I can see the hotel now. Hope the food is good.
You know, the realization that I was sort of felt like I did and that I wanted to stop, that was almost the worst bit, was this realization that I wasn't going to be able to do it and that I didn't really care either way whether I did it or not.
This series of Explore is supported by The Economist. Thank you very much to them for helping us get this show on the road. If you're a UK-based listener, you can get a free print copy of The Economist by texting the word cycle to 78070. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects, from politics and business to science, technology, the arts, and even sport. For over 170 years, The Economist has delivered trustworthy intelligence that helps people like you choose where to stand on the issues that matter most. And one of the issues that matters most at the moment is Brexit. Don't all switch off. I know we're sick to the back teeth of it by now, but I've been reading The Economist for a few months, and their coverage of Brexit has really interested me. I know that my feelings about Brexit have been challenged, if not changed, by the factual reporting by the magazine. They have a column about British politics that's named after Walter Badgett, who was the editor from 1861 to 1877. He was a political commentator of his day. He wrote several books, and the name lives on in the magazine in what is a kind of de facto leader column. Rather than being written by a named journalist, it uses the neutral voice of the magazine, and so it doesn't have the obviously opinionated voice of some of the newspaper columnists. And with that, I think you get a sense of neutrality from it. This week they had a piece titled "The Case for Another Vote on Brexit is Gaining Strength." I think the magazine's great strength is that even on its website, it avoids the pressure of rushing to judgment. And on a day of seismic breaking news in the world of British politics like we had this week, there's no rolling live blog, there's no articles with embedded tweets. I'm not saying those things don't have a place in political coverage, it's just that I note from The Economist a sense of confidence that the right thing for them is to wait until the dust has settled before adding something of substance to the mix. So I'll look out next week in their next issue and see what they've made of all that has gone on this week. The Economist is a smart guide to the forces changing your world, and if you'd like to get a free copy, you can do so by texting the word cycle, that's C-Y-C-L-E, to 78070. It makes sense in this first episode of Explore to focus on the transcontinental race, which was founded in 2013 by Mike Hall, the late Mike Hall, whose presence will be felt throughout this series because of the stature that he had in this world of endurance bike riding and racing. And this type of riding, type of racing, has really captured the imagination recently, and we've seen that with EF Education First and their sponsorship with RAFA. They've re-signed Lachlan Morton for the 2019 season, and Morton is a good pro racer, but he's also, you know, interested in the world of bikepacking. He made a very good film called Thereabouts about his own bikepacking adventures. And this is really new for me because I cover professional cycling, but there's something about the transcontinental which really taps into the early days of the Tour de France in a way. In 1903, they all set off from a cafe just outside Paris, and it was man against man, and the transcontinental is man and woman against the course that they've got to plot. But it seemed quite an intimidating world to me, an awful lot of cycling to be done. I'm a bit too soft for this sort of thing. But Hannah, is it something that appeals to you at all?
I think that it's definitely got a mystique to it. So, and I think that that's something that's quite appealing. For anyone that does endurance sport, there's something about it where you go and test yourself and your limits, and you try and find out what you've got inside and what metal you're made of. And the more and more people I speak to and talk to through doing the series and listen to their journeys, it sounds ridiculously hard, and they go through some real lows and obviously some highs. But yeah, there's definitely a whole dose of euphoria, I think, that you get from it at the end.
For somebody like me sitting at home in front of my computer, I can watch the dots as they move their way across Europe. I'm really up for that, dot watching. But in this episode, we're going to hear from a couple of people who rode this year's Transcontinental, the winner, and someone who didn't make it.
Yeah, so we're going to hear from James Hayden, who has won the TCR for the last 2 years running. And then we also speak to Richard Abraham, who this was his first year riding it. And unfortunately, he only got in about 2,000 kilometres in and had to scratch and had what he describes as a bit of a meltdown in Hungary. So
a meltdown in Hungary. Well, I've had some Hungary style meltdowns in my past. but 2,000 kilometres in and counting that as a failure, I don't think that that can even be counted as a failure. So it'd be interesting to hear what Richard makes of it. But before we hear from James and Richard, who you spoke to, Hannah, let's first hear from Tom Wally, our producer extraordinaire. He's a bike racer, he's a bike rider. He produces Huey's Six Music Show, and he produces this series of Explore, and he's going to tell you all about the Transcontinental.
Thanks, Lionel. Yeah, I've just got back myself, actually, from bike ride. Only 2 hours, not quite the Transcontinental. And actually, it's quite ironic to have me do this TCR explainer, because I am someone who doesn't really enjoy doing anything beyond 6 hours on a bike. Well, actually five, probably four and a half with a cafe stop. But that's not to say I'm not fascinated by the Transcontinental, because I am. I find myself, like Lionel, avidly watching the dots each year that the race takes place. And I think it's really captured my imagination because of the sheer size and scale of the event, but also because several friends of mine have taken part over recent years as individuals and also riding as pairs. Now, the Transcontinental Race describes itself as the definitive self-supported bike race across Europe. The key there being self-supported. If you want it, if you need something, you've got to bring it with you or buy it along the way. There's no going back to the team car. It's a beautifully hard bicycle race, simple in design and complex in execution. It was founded, of course, by Mike Hall, and we'll hear more about him later in the series. It was first held in 2013, and it went from London to Istanbul that year. The 2018 race started in Herodsbergen, famous for the Mer from the Tour of Flanders, to its new finish in Meteora in Greece. Now, there's no set route for the race, but if you're a dot watcher like I am, you will notice that a lot of the riders follow the same or quite similar routes, and that's because there are four checkpoints along the way in Austria, Slovenia, Poland and Bosnia and Herzegovina. Now, three of the first four events were won by a Belgian rider. That was Christophe Alleguette. 230 solo entrants this year, plus a dozen or so of those pairs teams. James Hayden, who we're going to hear from in this episode, won the race in 2017 and 2018. This year, he took 8 days, 22 hours and 56 minutes. And his route was a massive 3,405 kilometres. Matthew Falconer, now he came second after moving from 9th to 2nd in the final 2 days. You can imagine what sort of an effort that must have taken. And Bjorn Leonard, he was 3rd. The quickest woman was Edie Harrison in 13 days, 15 hours and 32 minutes. There was a finishers party at Pub 38 at the end of the 16th day. And for most riders, the goal is to arrive in time for that. But even that requires an average of about 250 kilometres a day. I think the most I've done in a day is about 200. So that is an extraordinary effort. Neil Matthews, he was the last finisher this year, taking almost 40 days. That's kind of my speed, I reckon. Mikko Mäkipää is the only rider to complete all six editions of the TCR. And entries for the seventh edition open at the end of November. Now, there are 10 rules to the TCR. 1. Ride from start to finish via the checkpoints. 2. No third-party support, resupply or lodgings. No drafting other than pairs partners. All forward travel must be self-powered. Travel by ferries only on approved routes. All riders must maintain evidence of their ride. Inactive for 2+ days without contact equals scratch. You're out. No insurance, no helmet, no lights. Scratch. Riders must know and obey local traffic laws. And 10, I think the key one here, ride in the spirit of self-reliance and equal opportunity.
Rafa, adventure starts anywhere.
Thank you to our title sponsors, Rafa, for helping us get the wheels rolling on this first series of Explore. Rafa's range includes many items that are ideal for bikepacking or endurance riding. When you're on a long ride, you want to carry some stuff with you, and it can be uncomfortable and irritating to pack everything into your back pockets of the jersey you're wearing because inevitably they begin to feel full and start to sag. The answer may be Rafa's cargo winter bib tights, because they have pockets in the back and on the thigh so you can carry the essentials in comfort. The pockets offer easy access and the bib tights themselves are versatile and weatherproof. You can find the cargo bib tights in the Explore range on rafa.cc. Now, Hannah, before we hear from twice winner James Hayden, let's hear your interview with Richard Abraham. I found this really fascinating because it puts into context just what an undertaking it is to tackle the transcontinental race, let alone going into it hoping to win.
Kind of knowing what I know now about the event, it feels like it was a slightly different person that started that event, both in sort of my naivety and of what the event was going to be like, which was just inevitable because I'd never done it before, but also the sort of attitude that I had going into it, and I feel now if I try and imagine myself back in that position, I feel like a different person imagining it, in a way that I feel like I would sort of pull up alongside me from earlier this year and, you know, see a different person slightly, see somebody who was probably quite obviously very anxious about what was going to happen, about what the event was going to be like, but also just going into it with a very different attitude. It feels a long time ago because I think I changed quite a lot during the race itself and the process of kind of dealing with the whole thing. I got almost 10 days in, so almost 240 hours, just a little bit of the way into Hungary, geographically speaking, at which point I I stopped. You could sort of feel it building. I mean, I felt like stopping from like day two in a way, because it doesn't feel pleasant. You're riding your bike far too much, and you're not giving your body anywhere near the amount of rest it should have. You're not allowing yourself more sleep, because that means you're going to go slower, and it's a race, and somebody's going to overtake you. So in that sense, you can sort of feel your body slowly getting more and more tired, and little niggles that happen. Sometimes they sort of correct themselves, or sometimes they don't, and they just get worse. And I could feel there were parts of me that were definitely getting worse. Saddle sores, let's leave it at that. That wasn't getting any better. I got to a point, a really inauspicious point in Hungary, where there was like almost nothing there on the outskirts of a town, and that was like the mental drive just disappeared, and that just, something just snapped. I think physically I'd felt horrible for days, but the drive and the will to keep on top of that and to just ignore that just suddenly disappeared, and that was really unexpected. The worst bit was this realization that I wasn't going to be able to do it, and that I didn't really care either way whether I did it or not. That was almost sort of more of a shock to the system than the actual sort of getting off the bike in the first place. I phoned my girlfriend, and she was at work, which was probably a little bit selfish of me, but you know, you sort of stop thinking of like normal life and normal routine, and the fact that somebody that you might want to speak to is at work at that point didn't really enter my mind. Yeah, and just sort of talked about like where I was and what I was thinking. That I was thinking that, well, this might, you know, might be it, and I don't want to carry on, but I feel like I should carry on. It would probably be horrible to listen to that conversation again, just like the sort of mumblings and inner demons and inner conflicts of a broken and tormented man on a roadside in Hungary. It doesn't matter who you speak to. There was no way that anybody I spoke to could tell me what I wanted to hear. What I wanted to hear was something coming from me that said, actually, yeah, you do want to carry on, and that, you know, your ankle isn't that bad, and it's not going to hurt if you carry on now. And there's nothing that anybody can tell you really once you reach that point, I don't think, or it certainly didn't feel like it at that point. As soon as I got off the phone, you suddenly realize that there is more to life than this race. There is more to life than what you're doing, and that there's more to life that's than what has been your entire universe for, well, 10 days. It helped me come to terms with it, come to terms with quitting anyway, because it's something that I'd wanted to do for years, really, and that I'd been thinking about doing ever since I'd applied for it, which was November of the previous year. If you've thought about and prepared for something so much, then as soon as that comes to an end, it's can be quite a hard thing to deal with. Sometimes the hardest bit is coming to terms with that, giving yourself a sense of purpose, or just sort of dealing with that the conclusion to something like that, that's always been this like future project or thing that you're totally engrossed in, and then it's no longer there. And that was a bit of a shock to the system, really. This is getting pretty philosophical, isn't it? I think what it did do is that I no longer have quite the same sort of burning desire to prove myself. Cycling kind of forces people to think like that, you know, next time you go up a hill, you're going to ride it faster, or, you know, next time you do a race, you're going to get one position better, or cycling just lends itself very well to that sort of stuff. And so sort of logical in my mind to try and do something a lot tougher than anything I've done before. And what I've come away from now, and maybe this will change with time, but I'm kind of much more resolved to just enjoy it for what it was and what it is. So I guess in that sense, that's kind of a personal change. So when I scratched, I wasn't that far from getting home. I was able to get home within 36 hours, And the first people I spoke to were this lovely couple of blokes in a bike shop who I phoned up, and they were happy to sort of box up my bike for me, because I just couldn't be bothered to do that myself and try and find a box at the airport in Vienna where I was going to try and get home from. They hadn't really heard of the race before, and so I was sort of trying to explain to them what it was and why I felt like I did. But then the best thing was meeting another chap in the airport who'd had to scratch, and he hadn't made it as far as me, but had still wound up at Vienna airport. And I think he'd been run over by a car, and that sounds awful, but I think like a car ran over his foot. And so he'd spent a night in A&E, or as he described it, as B&B, which is sort of transcontinental mindset. It was a free board and food. We just sat and shared a sandwich and a cup of tea in Burger King in Vienna airport, and just chatted about what had happened to us and what our races had involved, and you know, how much we put into it beforehand and planning for it, and how it had changed us. But being able to talk that over with Chris, which is his name, was just the best form of emotional rehab I think either of us could have had, because I was just feeling really glum. And just totally changed my mood by doing that. And I think that was pretty crucial, really, in terms of setting me back to normal life afterwards. So thanks, Chris. If you're listening, thank you. Everyone's experience of it is different, but I'm still not convinced that I would go back and do it again next year. I would really love it to carry on for another few years, at the very least, the event, and I don't really see any reason why it shouldn't, given its popularity and the sort of interest in the event now. And I'd love to be able to go back maybe in a couple of years' time and have another crack, but I'm not sure whether next year is the year. What I do want to do is go back to, certainly go back to Eastern Europe and go to the countries that I had planned to go through, but I didn't. Actually, thinking about it, this is something I sort of promised myself. I said, if I don't go and race it next year, then I want to go and volunteer on it, because that just looked fantastic. I'll never forget meeting the group of volunteers on the Polish-Czech border, which was checkpoint 3, control point 3. They were up there in the pitch black on this mountaintop, sort of wrapped up in sleeping bags and drinking tea and eating dark chocolate, and you know, just listening to some stories of these people coming in, and it just felt like a really nice way of being part of the event without actually doing it, without any of the misery of doing it, if there is the opportunity to go back and volunteer to some extent in one of those places, and wherever the checkpoints are next year, then I'd love to do that. So you might look at that and think, well, riding a couple of thousand miles across Europe to reach one of these checkpoints, well, isn't that exactly what you do in the race? But it would be totally different. The experience of doing that would be so different, because for me anyway, I don't think I'm a natural racer. I'm not somebody who thrives on sort of competition, for want of a better word. And I found that the kind of racing element of it, this sort of constant pressure and this sort of drone in the background the whole time, I found that quite stressful and quite tiring. And this is what separates it from just going out and riding across Europe from Belgium to Greece, is that if you weren't riding in that race situation, you could do what you want. If you only want to do 100 miles, or you want to do 50 miles, or it's raining, you don't want to go anywhere at all, it doesn't matter, because it's your own little trip down. If you want to jump on a train and finish it on a train, you can do that. The fact that it's a race and there are criteria about outside assistance and obviously jumping on a train is not a viable option, that just flips the whole experience entirely. It's like translating the whole experience into another language. You can't really come close to replicating that just by going on a long bike ride across Europe. You have to be in that race situation, and that brings with it, obviously it brings with it its own challenges, but you get to experience a continent, a whole range of countries through that lens, and kind of they speak to you in that language of the whole race, and that's a really unique experience for me anyway. Having toured a bit beforehand, it was a completely different experience. So the idea of not doing the race but riding out to the control point, you know, that, yeah, very different thing.
Science in Sport. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring this series of Explore. You can get 25% off all their products at the Science in Sport website, that's scienceinsport.com, by entering the code SISCP25 at checkout. That's SISCP25. Now let's hear from one of Science in Sport's ambassadors and a man who took on a really serious challenge a couple of summers ago.
Hi, my name's Hayden Groves. I rode all three Grand Tours last year in 2017. Yeah, that's the Giro d'Italia, Tour de France, and Vuelta a España, total distance of just over 10,400 kilometres. Not only did I do that, I'm also an ambassador for Science in Sport, and at the same time I raised over £100,000 for the charity Cure Leukemia. Naturally, you are what you put in your engine, and it's vitally important to get your strategy correct, not just for one day or the next day, but you're fueling for 3 weeks. You've got to think about each day, starting off with a full tank, and obviously how you top that up at the end of the day and how you recover. Real food first. You know, you're governed by what was there on the breakfast buffet, but generally there'll be eggs, and I'll have 3 to 4 eggs, and there's pretty much everything that you need in an egg, so the perfect go-to-work-on style food. A lot of carbs, fruit, yogurt. We would have a transfer to the start of a stage, so during that I'd top up with a whey gel. So you're starting the recovery process before you've even started riding. Certainly electrolytes in one bottle, and with the other one I'd have something like a Go Energy or Go Hydro. So it had some carbs in there, so every time I'm taking a drink, I'm just topping up the carbs, very important. After lunch I'd then, you know, go on to some gels or certainly something caffeine related in the afternoon, or if we had a big climb coming up, yeah, definitely.
You know, it takes a month to recover and another month to get back to normal. And so I've actually just started about 3 weeks ago. I've started cycling again properly. And so I'm back in training, which was really nice. I'm James Hayden, and I'm back-to-back winner of the Transcontinental race. Really, for me, it came around for two reasons. One, I wasn't proving to be very successful at road cycling, and so I decided I needed to do something else. And then two, I really enjoyed going touring and exploring and things. And so I combined, you know, having a competitive nature and a love of explore. And I'd heard about the Transcontinental, and I thought it was like the perfect solution to combine everything that I loved doing on a bicycle.
And so you obviously have got, it was your fourth year, of doing it this year. How did it feel going back into there, having sort of one win the year before, going back in as the sort of the reigning champion, so to speak?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, like, if you've been successful at something, it's really easy to be complacent and just not appreciate the amount of effort that you put in previously. And so I went away and I specifically, you know, set out a plan to not do that. And I trained in much the same way, but I trained harder and longer, and I was away in Livigno for longer, and so I was really, really fit when I started, and I knew what I needed to do, and I just put it in action, really. And it was quite straightforward, but there was a lot of hard work and preparation that went into making that possible. Yeah.
And when you're on the start line, do you kind of, you go back and then people look at you differently and kind of almost sort of measure themselves up against you, do you feel? How was it like on the start line?
it's hard to say what other people do, but I mean, in the beginning, when I first started out, first, second year, I was always measuring myself against other people and going, oh, look at who it is. I've got to, you know, beat them. But like, perhaps I just ignore and don't worry about that kind of thing. Now people do what they want. But the start itself is just magical. You know, everyone's equal, and there's no, you know, I won before, I'm greater than you or anything like that. It's just, or, you know, you finished and you haven't. It's just everyone's equal, and it's just about enjoying the atmosphere. And, you know, you can see the nerves and the intrepidation of people doing it for the first time, and so you kind of want to kind of comfort them and say, oh, it's going to be all right, enjoy it, you know, just get through the first night. And then, you know, I'm quite focused on doing my own thing as well, so it's really exciting.
And did you speak much to Bjorn on the start line? Obviously he was the person who came second to you last year.
Yeah, Bjorn and I have a good friendship, and we have like a real sporting rivalry and things, so we saw each other at the start, we spoke for ages, and then there's a photo of him and I together and things, you know, having a hug and wishing each other the best and stuff like that. So, yeah, I mean, I think this year we didn't cross paths on the first night, but I know last year, or the year previously, we crossed paths on the first night and spoke for about 20 minutes and things like that, you know, about the road ahead and stuff. And yeah, it's camaraderie, really.
And do you ever kind of look at, as you're going, do you look at other dots and see where they're kind of taking roots, or does that ever make you change your mind or anything whilst you're on yours?
No. It's an easy way to lose a lot of time. I get distracted. So there's kind of two questions there. Do I watch the dots and things like that and see where I am in relation to other people? And no, for the first 5 days, I ignore it, because I'm going as fast as I can. I can't go any faster. And there's no point in going any faster, because I'm just going to, you know, blow myself up if I do. And then secondly, you know, do I change what I do based on where other people are going? Completely not. And the like prime example is back in 2017 when I took this what people called weird route through Hungary and things like that, and Bjorn went through Austria and stuff, and people going, James is mad, why is he going this way? And you know, I'd researched that route, I thought it was better, and I stuck with it because I'd done the homework,
and it obviously paid off.
Yeah, I think so. My route's normally pretty good, and it's, I think it's one of the things that I'm known for, is having a pretty solid route. So
how do you start to tackle that when you first kind of see where the checkpoints are, and how do you sit down and start to tackle that?
I think the answer depends on if you ask me like now or you ask me 4 years ago, because of the experience I have in knowing how to go about that. So now it's a lot simpler process, and I know, you know, what a certain road in Bosnia is going to be like looking at the map. But back then I didn't understand the road network system and things, so I needed to learn that. And you can't just go on like Google Maps and check that, because it's not necessarily going to be up to date. You had to try OpenStreetMaps and, you know, Strava heat maps, you can check there. And then you can check segments on Strava, and I messaged someone this year on a segment to ask what it was like and what the road quality was like and things like that. And he messaged me back saying, and this was about checkpoint 4 in Bosnia, and he said, yeah, it's great, you know, you'll be fine, enjoy it. And afterwards I realized that he'd ridden on it on a mountain bike. And so perhaps, you know, you need to double check what bike they're using when they ride it, because they might think that you're going to use a mountain bike when no, you have to use a road bike. But I think a myriad of resources is the best answer. And then I use Ride with GPS to plan my routes, because you can get all the different maps up on there and stuff. So yeah, loads of sources.
And when you get to the start line in Belgium, what's kind of going through your head when you first start that pedal stroke and head off? How does the mind focus?
Relief that, like, you know, the training and the preparation and all the kind of perhaps more boring things are done, and I can just get on with what I enjoy doing, which is just racing to the limit, you know. And so it's just happiness, actually, is what I have.
And so this year, obviously the race went well for you, but what were the moments of it that you felt like you enjoyed, or were there any?
Yeah, interesting question. People talk about this like type 1 and type 2 fun, and I never really quite understood it, but I understand it now. And type 2 fun is apparently things that you don't enjoy while you're doing them, but you enjoy afterwards. And people classify TCR and these other races a lot of the time as type 2 fun for them. And perhaps that's why I didn't understand it, because for me it's really not type 2 fun, it's type 1. I enjoy it while I'm doing it. And I don't understand why you do something if you didn't enjoy it while you did it, because, you know, it's a lot of pain and suffering to have to wait for the enjoyment at the end. But like, honestly, I just love doing it, you know. The pain and these things, yeah, they exist and they're real, but at the same time, you know, seeing all these amazing places and, you know, just pushing yourself to the absolute limit and finding self-achievement and things is just, that's my idea of happiness. So it's fun.
Do you think, though, that over the last 4 years that you've been doing it, you're able to deal with suffering a lot better than what you did when you first started 4 years ago?
No. The short answer is no. And that was essentially the issue that I had in the first time that I did it, is that I could push myself and suffer a lot further than I was actually physically capable of. So I you know, destroyed my neck and my legs and things like that because I wasn't physically at the point of equilibrium with my mental strength. But now my mental strength and my physical strength are in better equilibrium, really. And so I can, you know, maximize that or make sure that I'm not pushing too hard in one sense and looking after the other.
So do you feel like you're almost are a bit more sensible with how far you're willing to push your body? Sorry.
Yes, and I think that's really evident. Like, if you followed the race this year or even last year, and you looked at the tracker for perhaps the first few days, or you check my arrival position at the checkpoints, I'll never really be first at the first, second, or perhaps third anymore. It's always going to be like fourth or fifth or something, because it's not a race to the first checkpoint, it's a race to the finish. And you need to manage that effort so that you can get to the finish as fast as you can. For me, you know, the idea is first, but still as fast as I can, and not to the first checkpoint as fast as you can. And a lot of people make that mistake. And year after year, and I kind of said to someone last year after the race, look, don't do that, you know, do this. And I tried to give them some advice. They did exactly the same thing this year. And I was just kind of smacking my head against the brick wall, really.
I guess it's almost like the long game, or playing the long game, is obviously the way to do it, isn't it? So over the last 4 years, what kind of tactics do you think have you developed from a physical point of view and a mental point of view to help you with it?
Yeah, good question. I mean, the tactics that I've developed are obviously the things that are now the skill set and the decision-making process that enable me to win, really, and perhaps lessons that I've learned and the hard way, which is obviously the painful way. You know, things very much like, it's not a race to the first checkpoint, it's a race to the finish. You know, in the first year I did it, I arrived at Mont Ventoux first, thinking I'd almost won the race because I was there first, and I was so far from the actual reality of getting to the finish, and I didn't get to the finish that year, and I learned that one. And that's a key lesson. I mean, there's other things, you know, not wasting time, being efficient with your time and things like that, which some people find easier than others. And it's just, you know, it is a 9-day race for me and maybe 30-day race for other people. And staying focused towards the goal for that length of time is difficult, and it requires a lot of, you know, dedication to do that and complete focus to do it. And some people can't quite get that right, and some people can. And I think that's one of the things to get right, is the focus towards why you're there and why you're doing that and what you want to get out of it.
And so with a lot of these races, one of the main things that I think probably a lot of people, or I imagine a lot of people, struggle with is the whole thing of solitude. How is solitude for you?
Fine. I go cycling with other people about once in a year, and then it reminds me that I hate cycling with other people. So no, yeah, it's absolutely fine. Cycling for me is a solitary thing.
And so, but there's obviously moments when you're doing the race and you bump into people, which must be quite a kind of like a warming moment if you've had kind of a hard time.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a warming moment for hard times, because I'm quite capable of dealing with hard times myself mentally, and I don't need that kind of companionship for other people to make me feel better. But less so than other people, I do bump into people, but normally because I'm at the front, it's like perhaps for the first day and then that's it. I won't see anyone for the rest of the race. So this year I saw Bjorn, and we on the first day, and we rode together for about 20 minutes. We were just winding each other up about who had the longer route or the most elevation and things. I think he had a slightly longer route and I had a bit more elevation, and we were arguing for about 20 minutes over which one was worse and which one was better. And then all of a sudden he was like, oh, and he peeled off left, and I kind of went straight on, and that was it. And, it was just friendly sportsmanship, really. I don't actually always have the shortest route or the flattest route. Some, you know, people have better, but it's just you got to pick the right route for you. And me, often that is taking the slightly hillier route over the longer, flatter route, because I don't mind a climb. But you know, especially going through Hungary this year, it was flat for like 300k, and that actually gets quite torturous on the body, because you can't really change around in your position. You're just sat in your aero bars, rock solid, not moving. Whereas if you're climbing and going up and down a bit, you can move your position and things. So there is a little bit of an angle to that as well.
And when you get moments in the race, obviously you said about dealing with things quite well on your own, when you find those moments, the tough moments, how do you kind of get yourself through those, do you think?
I don't know. It's difficult because I'd say they're kind of, you don't want to be getting into that position in the first place. And normally if you're having a difficult time mentally, it's probably because you've not eaten enough or not drunk enough or not slept enough. And so my initial advice is have a sleep, eat something, have a drink, and you'll probably feel better after that, even if it's like 20 minutes or an hour's sleep. You'll feel better afterwards. And so that's advice that I always enact. And then just remember that, you know, you're going to get to the end at some point. You just got to keep going. So if you get, you know, a problem with your wheel or your bike or, you know, your digestive system or anything, and they're all issues that I've had, you just have to take the time out to let that sort itself out, and then keep going, really, and just don't lose sight of getting to the end rather than just having the issue.
So you don't kind of call back home for support or anything, or ring your wife or anything like that?
No. Just I don't know. Maybe some people do that. For me, perhaps that does. I guess there's a grey area on like moral rules of support and not support. And perhaps for me, I might see that as a bit like support, because emotional support is as much as physical support. And I wouldn't do that. But yeah, just, you know, before the race, I sit down and I work out things that might go wrong, and I work like a risk matrix, and I work out what I do if it goes wrong, and I work out the risk it poses to the overall, so I know what I'm going to do if something does go wrong. And generally, anything that goes wrong will be on that list, because I've got the experience to put it on and off the list now. And so if something does go wrong, then, you know, I just get on with dealing with the problem. There's no point in having to cry about it, you know, because it's not going to sort anything out. Just deal with it, you know.
And so some of the unexpected things that can happen, obviously, last year in 2017, within the first 24 hours, there was the fatality of Frank Simons, which obviously was something that was incredibly tough for the organisers to deal with after everything that had happened with Mike. How did you feel when you first found out about that? How do you kind of deal with that when you're on the road?
Yeah, I mean, there's no right or wrong way to deal with it. I, you know, just thought about why I was there, and I thought about what I would want people to do if it were me, and I decided that I would keep racing to the finish as fast as I could. You know, perhaps that's for some people not what they do, and that's totally fine. I know a lot of people decided to retire at that point, and I respect that decision, because we're all individual and we have to make the right decision for us. So, you know, just try and think about what's right for you and put that forward.
And are there any moments on that ride where, I mean, you obviously seem very well adapted to being able to deal with like the sleep deprivation or anything like that. Is there any times when you feel particularly vulnerable or you're worried about your safety or anything like that?
Yeah, perhaps for me the answer to this question is different to some other people you might ask. You know, I'm a bloke and I kind of don't worry about, you know, things going wrong and stuff, because I don't know, if things are going to go wrong, they're going to go wrong. There's no point. I don't waste my time worrying. And I don't need to do things differently. Like, I know some people might turn their trackers off, some people don't know where they stop and they sleep, but I just tend to not worry about these kind of things. But, like, for example, I was on a road this year and I did a risk assessment in my head of this road, and I didn't think it was safe. So I took the next opportunity to turn off that road and took some side roads, which added maybe 20 kilometers and, you know, 40, 50 minutes to my overall time, but I made that decision just to proactively take a different route. And I called the organizers and I said, you know, I know we banned that road last year, this road isn't as bad as that, but maybe just give people a warning, let them know it's not great, so they could proactively make that decision before they found themselves in the situation. And I think, you know, just looking out for each other, that was what I was doing there.
And when you see, so for example, this year we saw the transatlantic race organizers downgrade theirs to just what they classify as a ride. Do you think that actually has any difference, based on the fact that they wanted to make it more, that people were a bit more took a safer route or thought about things a bit safer? Do you think it actually has that much difference?
I mean, I know Adrian, who runs that race, and I asked him about that decision and why. We had a good conversation about it, and I won't repeat that because that was kind of private. But my answer would be that, you know, everyone has to do things for themselves, and I don't think that there's any issue in calling it a ride. People will still turn up to race if they want to, but at the same time, perhaps calling it a race might discourage some people from participating who don't really want to race but just want to ride. And, you know, it's his race. He can do what he wants, and if that's what he's happy with, you know, that's fine. I know Mike, when he was running TCR, was always, you know, this is a race. It is a race. Don't come if you want to do, you know, just a ride to get to the finish, because, you know, it's a race. You know, there's no right or wrong way, and, you know, inclusion for everyone, really. So, yeah.
So, on the race that you had this year, your background is engineering, and were there any mechanicals or any problems that you had to sort this year at all?
Yeah, I think if you get through the race without any, then you're the luckiest person alive and go and buy a lottery ticket or something. But, like, again, at the same time, you don't get to the finish first if you've had big issues, which I didn't. Obviously, I had two issues this year. In Albania, I got a nail that was about 5 centimeters long, straight through my tire and straight through the rim. And the worst thing about that was actually it was quite difficult to pull out because my hands weren't working too well at this point, so it took me a while to get that out. But that was fine, and I just, you know, used a bit of tape to fix it, and it was all right. And then I got a tear in my sidewall from checkpoint 4, which, again, I just used a bit of tape to fix and got back on the way. And, you know, people could, in a situation like that where your sidewall is a bit torn and, you know, you still got, I think it was about 600 kilometers to get to the finish, it'd be easy just to start panicking and go, oh, you know, I can't keep cycling on this. What if it tears and gets worse and all these other things? And actually you can start then going and trying to buy a tire from a shop and all these other things. And you could waste a lot of time and you can, you know, end up wasting 6 hours just because you're not making conscious and rational decisions about a small issue. And so I just got a bit of, you know, Gorilla tape that I have strapped around my pump, put it over in the inside of the tire, and then when it obviously inflated the inner tube back up, that pushed against it, which kept it stuck on, and then that was actually thicker than the tire in the first place, so nothing's going to come through there. So, you know, it was fine to the finish. So, you know, I didn't waste any time. Well, 10 minutes fixing it, you know.
And so, I mean, obviously you've got the skills to be able to do that, so that's not when it starts to become type 2 fun, when you're trying to while away hours at the side of the road trying to fix a puncher. But there are people that are like that, aren't there?
Yeah, perhaps you should take yourself to a workshop on how to be a bike mechanic. I think anyone that starts the race that doesn't know how to really kind of strip most of a bicycle down and put it back together is probably not looked at all the things they need to look at in order to prepare for the race, and they probably should have given up one Saturday and a 6-hour training ride or 12-hour whatever they did on that Saturday, or even a Sunday as well, and gone and spent at a bicycle workshop to learn how to, you know, look after their bike.
So as far as tactics go with kit, what's your kind of setup with the bike? Because I know that you always use DI2, which I could imagine some people are like, what, why would you do that?
Yeah, I mean, I use DI2 because it's the most sensible thing, because when your hands go numb and stop working properly, you can still shift gears. But if you have mechanical group sets, you can't really shift gears. Mechanical gear sets snap. You know, DI2, I've ridden 70, 80,000, well, maybe even more kilometers on now. I've not had a single issue once, ever. Ever. And, you know, I don't need to touch wood because it's so reliable. Hydraulic brakes as well, so reliable. And so, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, I'm afraid to adopt that technology and things like that, and which is fine because they can stick with what they want. That's fine. I have no issue with people doing what they want. But for me, it is the absolute choice day in, day out. Yeah.
And so, in general, when you're away for the 9 days, how does your family cope with all of that back at home?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably longer than 9 days. I end up being away quite a lot because of the race and things like that. I mean, I spent 4.5 weeks in Livigno this year training just by myself, really locked away, and then I was away for, you know, a few days before the race, and then the race, and then a week or so after the race. I don't know, it is what it is. You go away when you work a job, don't you? So what's the difference? But Isabel came out to the finish this year, my wife, and we, you know, we had a holiday at the finish, and that was really nice and stuff. So it's 9 days, it's not really very long, is it?
And so your family, do they normally come out and meet you at the finish?
Sometimes. My stepdad Chris, he's come out for the past 3 years, actually, like, yeah, 3 years now, because he hadn't planned to come out on the second one that I did, but they saw the state that I'd got myself in, just racing so hard, and I turned up at the finish having ridden like 300 kilometers with a tear in my hamstring and things. And so he came out to the finish like on his own accord, because he knew someone needed to be there to kind of pick up the pieces and look after me, which I was really grateful for, because I was in a state. And then he came out the year after as well, just to hang out. And then my mum and Chris, they volunteered at the finish this year, and they were working at the checkpoint at the finish, checking riders and everything. So they love the race and they love being involved in things. So it's, I mean, they were as much there to do that as they were for me almost. And then Isabel came to the finish this year and had a holiday and we hung out. So yeah, my sister came as well this year. She turned up unannounced. So it was pretty cool actually. It was like family get together.
Do you feel, I mean, it's quite a nice place to have a family get together in Greece, so yeah. It's always good. Do you feel that it adds an extra pressure on top of you then when you know that they're going to be there? Because obviously the first year when you scratched, were there going to be people waiting for you at the finish then?
I'm really glad you asked that question. That's a really good question, because it's a mistake that so many people make, and one that I made in the beginning as well. And yeah, year after year after year, people scratch because they set themselves a time commitment to get to the finish by, you know, whatever day or date, because they know that their partner or their kids or whatever, they got something else to do. And then they know maybe, you know, after 5-6 days into the race that they're not going to be able to make that commitment anymore, because they just cannot ride enough kilometers a day to get there. And so they just lose it mentally. And when you lose it mentally, that's it, you scratch, they're done. And now, you know, it's okay for me to bring people to the finish because I know I'm going to get there. I know when I'm going to get there. And it's like, you know, I had a running joke this year with Isabel. I was like, be there on the Monday, I'm going to be there on Monday. Like, and there was just no two ways about it. I knew that was how I was going to go. But back in the early days, that wasn't the case. And I'd really advise people not to set a fixed time date on when they're going to get to the finish for whatever reason. But don't commit to it, be there on a set date. Just say, I'll get there as quickly as I can and I'll get there when I get there. And that is all you can do. And then that keeps you in a good mind frame throughout the race, because then you can be positive about getting there quickly, but not have that negativity creep in about missing deadlines that you've set. Because once that happens, the race is over.
So you advise them just to try and jump on a budget flight when you're about a day out?
Yeah, just don't bring your family to the finish, you know, because there's so many great people at the finish and there's so many other spirits, like, and you are absolutely ruined when you get to the finish, that really it's not going to be a great family holiday anyway. And there's so many like-minded, you know, and kindred spirits there that you'd much rather have a beer with and chat with than you know. So yeah, don't worry about bringing your family, or, you know, if you want to bring fine, you know, cool. But yeah, don't set yourself a fixed timeline. However you can do that is your choice, but you won't be alone at the finish because it's a family environment, you know, of all the other racers.
And so your parents, I mean, they obviously were, you said they were helping at the finish this year. What do they think about the culture, and how would you describe the culture of these type of events? So you call it a family. How would you describe it?
It's everything that other sports events aren't nowadays. You know, there's kindness, there's warmth, there's, you know, good spirit between racers, you know, it's, and there's no, you know, one-upmanship or anything like that. And it's about being the best version of yourself while helping others to be the best version of themselves as well. And, you know, it's just lovely.
And so you obviously, after doing that for 9 days, you kind of, you come back, and is there a post-race blues? How do you feel going back into, in a quotation marks, normal life again?
Yeah, I mean, post event, big event blues are a real thing, because you've committed so much time and energy and perhaps money, and, you know, you sacrificed a lot to do this one thing, and then hopefully you've been successful. Sometimes you haven't, and often when you haven't, you can get quite disappointed with that and upset. But also when you have been successful, you can be like a bit lost as well, because you're like, oh, I've put so much time into this, I've achieved this, that's great, but where am I going now? And so you need a bigger guiding picture to what you're working towards. And is it just that one race, or is it two races, or are you going to do that and then this? And if you have a bigger guiding picture of why you're doing it in the first place, then you can kind of keep working towards that even when that thing has finished. So yeah, I mean, I get back from the race and I'm kind of like full throttle into what I'm doing next, because it just keeps me occupied.
And are you, what's next for you then?
Something different, something big, something really exciting.
And so no TCR for next year?
At the moment, no. No, I think there's lots of other things out there, and I think it's time for me to try other things, and perhaps it's time for someone else to win TCR again.
What do you think about the announcement from EF Pro Cycling and how they are looking to target races like this for next year? I mean, you say you want the level to go up. Do you think that that's going to make a big difference?
I'm thinking of how to answer this question in a good way. I think there's a lot of talk. It'd be nice to see some action. And if you're not going to have any action, then be quiet, really. Either come and race or just be quiet. But don't use the race as publicity for what you're doing, perhaps.
And so do you think that actually it, if there were people, for example, some of their team that were on the start line of TCR next year, how do you think other people would react to that? Because I guess, do you think that will change the supportive nature of what the race is?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I'd like to think that people would embrace anyone wanting to race it with inclusion, because that's what the race is about. And it's about an equal playing field, and it's about people coming together and just having fun riding their bikes. And if that's why people are there, then anyone is entitled to be there. So, yeah.
Entries for the 2019 Transcontinental Race open at the end of November. Hannah, will your name be on the list?
Maybe not this year or next year.
But possibly the year after that. I think that's one of the things about it, isn't it? It isn't just the undertaking of doing the event, in whether it takes you 12, 17, 20 days, all of these events. It's the preparation. I mean, you can't really just go into it cold, can you?
Yeah, exactly. This is the thing. And later on in the series, we'll also hear from Coach Dean Downing. And I was asking him, realistically, how much prep do you have to put into these races? How many hours a week should you be riding? And it's so hard. It's really, really difficult.
Well, that's the Transcontinental Race. And as I said before, we heard from James and Richard there, these worlds are, they're never going to overlap, the worlds of professional cycling and endurance and ultra endurance racing. But there's a lot more in common than perhaps we would immediately think. And I think everything is moving in a certain direction. It wouldn't surprise me if, perhaps not next year, but maybe in a couple of years' time, we see riders who we recognise from the Grand Tour start lists actually trying to take on something like the Transcontinental. And what would be really interesting is seeing how the skills transfer, you know, whether this kind of endurance type of riding is in the same kind of bag as racing as a professional at, you know, very high intensity, very high speeds. For many years now, there have been sportives based on the great classics, the Tour de France, of course, the Etape. And every year, people set off to ride the full route of the Tour de France one day ahead or a couple of days ahead. I'm not saying that Tim Moore was the first person to ever ride the full route of a Tour de France, but probably one of the most well-known attempts. In 2000, he rode the route of the Tour and wrote a very funny book called French Revolutions about it. Later on, he rode the route of the 1914 Giro d'Italia as well, which was a very different kettle of fish. And in more recent years, the former footballer Jeff Thomas, who, well, he was diagnosed with leukemia and was very ill and given quite a low chance of survival, but he did survive. And in order to raise money for leukemia research, he set off to ride the full route of the Tour de France. And I remember I was working for a cycling magazine at the time. People said, oh, he's a footballer, he's got no chance, but he did it. And I think that just shows that if you're not having to go dead quick, you can ride 3,000 kilometres in 3 weeks.
Yeah, I think, if anything, the longer it takes you to do it, the more, the harder it is. You see, okay, we know the Tour de France is hard. We've seen the pros struggle. But when you see them people going out there and they're riding stages and it's taking them 11 hours or 12 hours to do that consecutively day after day after day, you need a lot of mental strength as well.
Every hour on the bike is an hour less recovery. That's the thing, isn't it? And well, for me, I'm a creature of comforts. I mean, it's terrible. I'd quite like to do the full route of the Tour de France in 6 weeks. That's the sort of challenge I'm up for. But Jeff Thomas has been back and ridden Tour de France routes again. He got a group together, including a chef called Hayden Groves, and they rode every stage of all three Grand Tours. That's the Giro d'Italia, the Tour de France, and the Vuelta a España. And Hayden actually wrote a cookbook inspired by the recipes of the towns and regions that they rode through. It's called Back in the Saddle, and that also was to raise money. And, well, riding the full route of the Tour, it's a good way to generate publicity for a cause. And that brings us on to our next feature.
Yes. I thought you were going to pronounce the French name, but you well and truly put that onto me. So yeah, there's a group of cyclists, female cyclists, called Donon de El Ovelo. I know I'm going to get some pronunciation police on that. And so they started doing that back in 2015, and they were riding the Tour de France the day ahead. And basically the name is to give the women a bike. And it involves them riding a day ahead of the tour to show basically that women are able, quite capable to ride that distance on a bike. So,
but in terms of riding the full Tour de France route, they're not just doing it for a tough holiday or a type 2 challenge, are they?
No, so it is, obviously it's to make a point. And I think that the first year that they did it, there was only a handful of them that did it, but then each year this got more and more, and this year there were actually 13 of them that did it. Obviously they ride a day ahead, which they explain from a navigation point of view, because all the arrows are out there and ready to go, which is quite interesting. But also with each year that they've done it, they get more and more people come and join them. So you can go and join them to ride so many stages if you want, or ride a stage with them. And I think they said when they got into Paris, there was around about 200 people that came along to ride it with them. So yeah, an absolutely great event. And the other thing that's quite interesting about it is that this year they actually had Skoda be a sponsor, gave them the cars and helped them with the sort of financially. And Skoda is actually a sponsor of the Tour de France. So it's kind of interesting how these sponsors are coming on board and what they're trying to say.
Yeah, they're obviously seeing the value in this kind of riding, and certainly it was really strongly on the radar this July. Who are we going to hear from, Hannah?
So we're going to hear from Tetiana Kalchova, who was one of the riders who did it. She's been doing it for a couple of years now, and also a rider who does a lot of work with Skoda, who does a lot of fixed criterium races, Juliet Elliott, and she actually joined them for one of the days after the Alps route this year.
So making a step up from fixed criteriums on little circuits to riding, 170, 180 kilometres?
Yeah, the day she joined them, actually, it was about 175 kilometre stage, and they called it a recovery day. So that was, she said it was definitely, they weren't allowed to get their heart rates very high, but yeah, I think they kind of wanted it after the brutal few stages in the Alps. Hi, are you okay?
Yes, I think it's fine. So my name is Tetiana Kalachova. Right now I live in Prague because of work, because I do science, and now I'm a postdoc in the Institute of Experimental Botany. My main life is to study plant responses to stresses. Cycling has been a hobby for me for the last 7 years. I just started it to try something different in my life, just to move a bit more. And then I started doing it like tourism, just to discover new places, meet new people. And then I went into mountain biking, and then I tried racing. And at some point, I ended up fully in love with road cycling. And it was the moment when I moved to Paris for work, and there everyone is cycling. So I just was lucky to meet the girls from my current French team, and I was racing with them for a couple of seasons. Now, because I moved, I don't race with them anymore, but I'm still a part of the Donon des Élevologies Monzon project. The first year when the project happened, it was just the initiative coming from girls themselves. It was kind of family affair, when three girls went to ride all the stages of tours, supported mostly by family, to like the parents were driving the supporting car. They stopped in the tents and stopped in the hotel sometimes, and they were not even sure if they can make it or not. But finally they did, and it was exactly the moment when I met them.
I am the creator, I don't know if the good word, with my girlfriend Claire. My name is Mathieu Istil. I'm a sort of manager of the competition team. Claire Floret and me, we are the two who create the project. For 4 years ago, we watched a movie, a French documentary about a French journalist who creates a project to do Tour de France one day ahead with French people people from the diversity, you know, black people, Arab people, white people, Asian people. He wants to show that France is mixed and there are many people from many countries. That's the France. We were drinking beer with Claire and watching the film, and we say, "Oh, it's crazy! Doing the Tour de France one day ahead, we should do it." But at the beginning, it was just for us, just a sort of a défi, just for us. And 6 months after, we create the club, the association, the women team, competition team, and we think how to promote, how to help women cycling. We remember the project one day ahead. We say, oh, maybe we won't do that just for us. We will do that with the club, with the association, to help people to see women cycling. And that's the beginning of the project.
Why do we do it? It has at least two big axes. Like first X, why me personally was involved there was the personal challenge. Because since I was riding the road bike, I was dreaming about Tour de France. I was dreaming about doing at least one climb of one of the mythic mountains that riders do. And the idea to perform all the stages by myself, to ride the same roads, was the interesting personal challenge, like to know more about what I can do, to go to know more about what I can achieve, and just to challenge myself. But from the general point of view, from like humanity point of view, we realize that it's very unfair that women do not have road cycling, like such a big road cycling event. So we decided that we're gonna ride it ourselves, and to show that amateurs, like even amateurs, can do it. It means being perfectly clean. It means having training, but not being professionals for cycling. And we can make it, and we can make it interesting, and people gonna watch it. So we would like to attract more attention of media and their organizers to get back the female Tour de France.
It has a very big impact on French people, and we were very happy because now French people know that there is a woman cycling, there is a team, there are many people that want women Tour de France back. But this year it was different. It was in the other countries. It was really crazy who were interested by our project. In USA, in UK, in Germany, it was incredible. And we are very happy because we know that in this country, women and men equality is more important, or more, this fight is more important. In France, people used to don't see women Tour de France. They used to. Oh, it's okay. There's no women Tour de France. Well, okay. But I understand. And when we talk with foreign journalists, that it's shocking for the other countries that there is no women Tour de France. And we were very happy with the foreign media coverage.
For us, it's not a race. So when it's flat, we ride all together. We respect the rhythm, the pace to be comfortable for everyone. But when it goes to the mountains, it's pretty useless to stay all together, because it's impossible to climb the whole day if rhythm is not yours. It's impossible to go slower and impossible to go faster. So we just split, and then we wait for each other at the top of the mountain.
I didn't know what stage I was going to be doing initially, but I was kind of given free rein to do whichever one I wanted. And the way it worked out, I actually went over to do one of the flatter ones. And I've got to say, I was pretty glad about that, because Those women are seriously strong. Hi, my name's Juliette Elliott. I rode with Donon Dozel Ovello. Did I say that right? I rode with them on stage 13 of the Tour de France this year. You might think, oh yeah, you know, they'll probably be tired by stage 13. But no, they're still like machines. And if I'd have had to do a really hilly stage or a mountainous stage, it would have been really hard. I'm not a climber, I'm a crit racer. So those long climbs are hard. So we rode from Bourg d'Oisans to Valence, and the stage was really flat by Tour de France standards. So the idea was that they would use that as a recovery day. And I actually made a video about it, laughing about the fact that they would call 175-kilometre ride a recovery ride. I mean, that's kind of crazy. My recovery rides are like an hour of sort of pootling about. But they actually decided to use it as an active recovery, keep their legs spinning and sort of flush out the lactic acid and stuff so that they'd be fresh to attack the hills on the next day. Some women, their main struggle was getting enough downtime, getting enough time to rest and recover for the next day, because they'd be finishing quite late, you know. And then by the time they've got all their stuff together, got on the bus, got to their accommodation, they'd be eating dinner at, say, 10:30 at night, and then going to bed really late and having to get up so early the next day to get prepped and back on the road again. So I think that by stage 13, that was really taking its toll. The impression that I got, what I was thinking whilst I was riding along with the women, was that it would be possible. It would be possible for women to ride that, you know. Like the women that I was riding with, Donon Dozel, they're not all pro racers. And so, yeah, we weren't going at race pace, but they're not pro racers. So what it made me think was, you know, I think female racers could certainly manage a Tour de France. If you know, non-professionals can ride it, then I think professionals could definitely race it. I think it seemed to have a really big impact this year. I mean, it just got everyone talking and debating the issue, which is, you know, the first step towards change, I think. But there's still a lot of disagreement about whether women should even have a Tour de France. And I'm talking about people who are, you know, who support women cycling. There are a lot of people saying, well, why are we focusing on this one issue? We've already got really good women's stage races, such as, you know, the Women's Tour and the Giro Rossa. Why do we keep focusing on this Tour de France thing? It's frustrating when you know that doors are closed to you and you want to have equal opportunities, basically. So, yeah, I kind of disagree with people who say, stop focusing on the Tour de France, just focus on what you've already got and grow it. It's like, well, no, like, I want the same opportunities for women. It's not such a big ask.
These 21 stages, it means like 3 weeks of life. It's a very big piece of life that we live together. And right now it seems to be far away, but I can remember each of them. During those 3 weeks, the memories depend on many things, like, for example, on physical conditions. So there were some tough stages, there were some easier stages. This Tour de France taught me how you can rest during 180 kilometers. Sometimes it can be just a relaxed stage. But from this year, I can say that I was in love with mountain stages. Personally, I prefer Alps over Pyrenees. So I think the Alpine stages this year, the one that ended at La Rosière, was beautiful, and Alpe d'Huez was beautiful. And of course, the last climb that ended up at Col de Bisque was just something very special, because when it comes to the end, and we realized that we did it again, and next time we're going to ride together will be probably in a year. So the last climb we normally do all together, singing, dancing on the bikes, and this is something very particular. And of course, a very special memory goes to the Champs-Élysées arrival. Because the same as for the men who compete all those 3 weeks, for us, even though we don't compete, it's a big thing that we performed. So the last stage is the friendship stage. This year, I think we had over 100 cyclists riding with us the last stage. And it was something, so we were riding all together in a very relaxed pace, just because we didn't want it to end so far. So the arrival of Champs-Élysées and the feeling that we did it, and those cobblestones on the Champs-Élysées, they're just something unforgettable. it's a very emotional moment. It's like when you cry because you cannot believe that you did it again, and all those people with whom you did it, they are now your family, and this is something like carved somehow on our souls forever.
You also mentioned the Col de Bisque as well. How did that feel when you were riding up that and when you got to the top?
Well, that was crazy. Because it was the last climb of the tour. We knew that after that we're going to drive to Paris and ride this end stage, but it was the end of the mountains. I mean, that this story ended up there. I remember it was foggy and a bit rainy at the bottom of the climb. But yeah, it was hard. But when we finished this, we were singing the song together, just because the emotions are there, and it's too much for a single human to leave all that. It is very binding moment. It's like when you feel so solid and you have an impression that you're not only yourself, but the part of my personality are also those 13 girls that are in the team. We are somehow very much united. I'm not the human that I was before I joined this adventure. I think it made us better people. I think it made us stronger, and it made us more attentive to the others. We knew more about what we can do, and we learned more about how we can help other people, how to support other people, and how to share the emotions, whatever they are. You're always somewhere on the edge of being angry, annoyed, happy, excited, and all this like at the same time. Like, it's everything is turned on 100%. Like, you're never bored. You always feel something very strongly. But after a couple of days riding, your brain is empty of everything except cycling. So you just pedal, eat, sleep, pedal, eat, sleep. And it's like meditation, but very tough meditation. But when you have to be focused at 100% of what's happening to your body, but at the same time, your thoughts are very free and very fluent, and they can like float around. So yeah, it's a particular experience.
They're not just out there to help publicize the fact they want a women's Tour de France. They're out there because they love cycling and because they want to go cycling for 3 weeks. And that was really apparent. You know, there's a great atmosphere and energy on the ride, and that made me want to go back next year. So I'm hoping that possibly I could go and do a few more stages with them next year, if they'll have me. I know they actually get quite a lot of people who want to go along and ride with them. And it's not very easy to organise extra people coming along for multi-day rides because of the logistics. You know, there's not enough room in the van and stuff like that. So it would be cool if they could set up a kind of a supporters ride that runs alongside theirs. So you could sort of join in on a multi-day ride and be able to chuck your bag in a car as well. So at the moment, it's just really hard to join them for more than one day because of the logistics.
This year, we have many, many, many people who wants to ride with us. It was incredible. Maybe twice last year. It was very crazy. And it's strange because sometimes people look at the girl as they were, important people or the girls, and we don't understand that. We are normal people. Why do you speak? It's crazy. You have some guys. Sometimes we arrive with cars, and we fix the bike. We put the clothes, and the people look at the girls. They put a distance. They look as they were. A movie star, or it was incredible. And the girls, they don't understand. Some guys talk about the name of the girls. Oh, it's Tetiana. Tetiana, she said, but how does he know my name? It was very, very strange. Very, very strange.
I think that this year we had even more attention from people, and we had many medias interested in what we are doing. And I really think that we are getting closer and closer to the moment when the organizers of the tour and cycling federations would not be able to resist anymore to this question. Like, because the question of place of women in cycling is arising stronger and stronger. And with the wave of feminization in sport that happens generally, I think people, journalists, cyclists, just start asking again and again, so why there is no Tour de France? There has to be the same opportunities for men and women, and the absence of women's Tour de France is just a like shining example, the bright example of that inequality that still exists. So I think, I really hope that soon we will not have to ride this anymore, because we will just take the camping car and we will cheer up the professional athletes riding women Tour de France.
So we've seen that obviously this is something that the girls are going to carry on doing for until they get what they eventually want, is a women's Tour de France, which doesn't necessarily have to be a 21-day stage race, but it has to be something that kind of represents what the women's peloton want. And so they'll be doing it again next year. Are we going to sign you up for a stage, Lionel?
Well, I'm thinking I could maybe do the Po time trial course, because the difficulty for me is I'll be covering the tour. It's very hard to get a day off because the race just, it's relentless. I don't know whether you know, but it's like on every day, and I'll be actually at the tour. But I was wondering whether I could, on the rest day, join up. But I'd have to look at the length of the stages, because I don't want to sign myself up for some 210-kilometre epic and then find that I have to, you know, climb off halfway through.
I think the time trial course is still pretty, it's still got a good couple of climbs in it. So although you are obviously going to be doing the actual time trial of 27 kilometres and not La Course, which is 5 laps.
Oh, yes, it is, isn't it? I've got to be very careful what I commit to in something that's going to be broadcast, Hannah.
I'm gonna get in touch with them and tell Tatiana that you're on the books for next year.
Well, on that note, I think we'd better wrap up the first episode of Explore. How have you found it?
Yeah, it's been great. I think that it's been a really interesting one to chat to people about. And yeah, there's actually some parts of it. You can feel quite emotional chatting to some of the people when they're sort of discussing about the highs and lows that they've gone through, and especially when there's certain people are doing it for some real kind of sort of personal reasons and like the charities and everything like that. So,
well, in this episode we've obviously talked a lot about the race across Europe, the transcontinental. A bit of a gear change next time, because we'll be talking about slow cycling. So until then, Hannah, thank you.
Thank you.
Next time on Explore.
One thing that used to scare me a little bit, actually, was in a country that's not that dissimilar to the UK. Well, it's dissimilar in terms of geographically, Australia. You know, culturally pretty similar. But I used to camp quite a lot in the middle of nowhere. You've been a sort of outback car park. It was a designated campsite, but it might be 500 miles from somewhere. And I'd be asleep. And at about 3 a.m, some fishermen would turn up, pissed as parrots, and they'd sort of sit quite close to me, getting even more drunk for about 3 hours, and then would leave the following morning. And I never quite knew. I mean, you hear all the, I don't know if you've seen Wolf Creek, but films like that and stories like that in the middle of the outback sort of preyed on my mind a bit. So it wasn't particularly nice camping on your own 500 miles from anywhere with a bunch of pissed Aussies nearby.
You have been listening to Explore by the Cycling Podcast. The producer was Tom Wally. Music in this episode, including our opening theme, Beyond the Black Veil, is by Moscow Youth Cult. Their latest album, Brutalist, is out now on Hello Thor Records. You can find it via hellothor.bandcamp.com. This episode also featured additional music by John Dix.